Today on Focus, two Illinois artists talk about their inspiration. For Chicago artist Christopher Baker, it's on the internet, where countless people post their video diary entries on YouTube. Can a mass medium provide an outlet for individual expression? Baker poses the question in his video installation at the University of Illinois' Kranich Museum. Meanwhile, Illinois State University's Claire Lieberman hopes to find her inspiration at the North Pole. She'll be headed there in 2 weeks, joining a ship full of artists and scientists. Lieberman talks about her project in the second half of our show. I'm Jim Meadows. Welcome to Focus. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. My guests today are both artists following specific points of inspiration, but those inspirations are different. Later this hour, we'll talk to Claire Lieberman, an artist and professor at Illinois State University. She's joining a group of artists and scientists who will be traveling by boat to the North Pole later this month. While Claire's inspiration will be the natural world, our first guest turned to technology for his inspiration and how technology affects people's social interactions. And Christopher Baker is an artist and professor at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago. His work, Hello World, or How I Learned to Stop Listening and Love the Noise, is on display now for the remainder of the year at the University of Illinois Kranich Art Museum. That's out on East Peabody Drive on the U of I campus in Champaign. Christopher, hello. Welcome to Focus.
Hello. Good morning, Jim.
And, you know, I went out to the Kranich Art Museum yesterday and spent some time with Hello World, and I recorded just a brief impression. Standing in the darkened gallery that houses Christopher Baker's Hello World installation, you're viewing a crowd of individuals, each one performing in their own video diary entry. Sometimes you may catch an individual's voice.
I dyed my hair over the summer. Black is not my natural hair color. So I'm the resident emo at school. I have a couple more. They're all friends.
But don't count on that voice staying around for long. And don't count on being able to find the owner of that voice among the thousands, yes, thousands of videos projected on the wall. There's a person in each one, sometimes two persons, staring into the camera, speaking, gesturing, sometimes dancing or playing the guitar. Male and female, sometimes in costume or wearing an animal mask. They're mostly young, but occasionally you see an older man's gray hair or a woman's old-fashioned Sunday hat. In Christopher Baker's installation, their name is Legion, and they are all talking at once. And that sound of all those voices goes on continuously at the Hello World installation. Christopher, I was actually wondering, do they keep it on all night as well?
Actually, I think they do turn it off when the museum is closed, to save energy and to keep it running okay.
But in a sense, on the internet from which you drew these videos, they are always there. And Christopher, I was wondering, was it the internet phenomenon by itself, or something about people and human nature? What was it that inspired this piece for you?
There's a kind of a collection of experiences that I had just as a participant in our sort of culture, but also as an artist working with new communication technologies. There are some pieces that I did earlier in my sort of art career where I was asking people to use their mobile phones to send text messages and leave voicemail messages for me, and I would basically provide a framework for them to express themselves. So those voice messages and those voicemail messages would then be, say, projected on the side of a building or incorporated into a larger audio work. And at the time, I was really excited about the prospect of using these new technologies as a way for people that maybe didn't have a voice in the past to express themselves in some way. But after doing those kinds of projects for a little while, I quickly found that those formats, you know, short messages like you might find with text messages, really weren't good conversational formats. There are good formats for kind of giving a funny remark, or, you know, practicing your curse words, or saying something silly about a friend. But I quickly became a little bit kind of skeptical of the democracy kind of inducing power of these kinds of technologies, and started to look a little bit deeper into what they might, you know, be good at. And I think that's kind of where Hello World came from.
Now, all of these technologies, it seems like you always run up against a wall. And I've read things before in history. I've seen people writing about all the wonderful potentialities that were going to be unlocked by the telephone, the phonograph, the motion picture camera, and yet it never quite works out that way.
Yeah, well, I think when we're dealing with new technologies, I mean, all of these technologies, and I think where a lot of my inspiration comes from, are cultural products. They're products that come out of our imagination as a culture and as a society. So they capture something very human about us. You know, like with communication technologies, we want to be in communication with people. We want to be able to express ourselves to others, to talk to others, to feel connected. And a lot of times the technologies that are, you know, come onto the market, whatever they happen to be, kind of oversell themselves a little bit. They promise, you know, more than they could possibly ever offer. So when a new technology like YouTube comes along, there's a lot of optimism, you know, that this will actually produce, you know, all of these new venues for people that were formerly marginalized. But you kind of forget the fact that now everybody's going to be talking, and it's going to be difficult to kind of sift through all of that and find, you know, the opportunities. Not to say that there isn't a bit of that. You know, I'm not totally pessimistic about them, but I think a lot of my work tries to administer a little bit of a reality check and look at the places where it doesn't quite live up to our expectations.
I want to welcome everybody to call in with your questions and comments, maybe your own stories about your artistic inspiration or your use of technology, and when you hit a wall with it. Call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Christopher, while I was in the in the room where Hello World is installed and gathering that sound, I just found myself sort of mesmerized by all those images. And even though I really, except in very rare instances, couldn't make out what any individual was saying, I found just the individuals and the differences between them, and sometimes the similarities, just to be something that I could see myself looking at for a long time.
Part of that maybe comes from the fact there was a bit of editing in the process. I didn't just haphazardly download, you know, lots and lots of YouTube videos. I was specifically looking for those moments of optimism and those moments of connection. So when I was searching for these videos, I was using search terms like my first video log or my first vlog, as they, I guess, were called at the time. And looking for people who are excited about the opportunity to express themselves, and they were maybe first timers, if possible. So I was specifically looking for people, you know, for people's faces, because I know that, you know, people are very attracted to faces, you know, on a very deep neurological level. And so I was looking for people that kind of had that typical webcam shot look, looking for people inside of maybe private spaces, broadcasting from their bedroom or their home or even a car sometimes. And I think having that continuity between the different images, you know, gives the viewer at least a little bit of an opportunity to kind of hook into that, the human side of this, not just the kind of mass media side of things.
So you did use some assisting software. I understand this was software that you designed yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. My background is in engineering, and so I made a transition a few years back into the arts and pursued a master's of fine arts at the University of Minnesota, and was able to take a lot of those technologies that I'd learned, you know, software programming and things like that, and kind of leverage them in a way that that maybe your typical traditional artist wouldn't necessarily be able to, you know, as easily. So I wrote a lot of software and scripts and things like that that allowed me to download lots and lots of videos and then move through them as quickly as possible. And that's actually that kind of relationship between art and technology is what I'm teaching up in Chicago in the Art and Technology Studies Department.
At the same time, there are thousands of faces up there. How many different faces are there on at any one time simultaneously?
At any one time, you know, I'm not exactly sure. It depends on how many screens you have, and it depends on you know, how long you stand there. I think the what I tend to tell people, because I haven't actually counted every single one, I have kind of a rough guess, but each mini screen, if you will, has a single video, and when that video runs out or finishes, then another one jumps right into its place, and so you don't really see those transitions.
I noticed as I was watching the whole screen, I would be aware of sudden flashes of white in an individual box, and I assume that marked the end of one video image and the beginning of another, but I could never catch one ending.
Yeah. I honestly think those flashes of whites are probably little artifacts in the original videos, and may or may not, you know, mark the beginning or end. But I think if you sat there and watched it long enough, you would see some transitioning through.
How long do some people watch this? I mean, you've had this up in other places. How old is the work, by the way?
The work was originally put together in 2008, and it hasn't really changed since then. It's kind of a snapshot of the internet at that time. In terms of how long people stay, I've seen people that kind of do the typical gallery look, you know, where they just come in and look quickly and you know, walk away, and then I've seen other people sit down. You know, I usually ask to, you know, for the opportunity to provide benches or something so people can sit in there for a little while. I think an average would be maybe 10 minutes or something like that, maybe longer, maybe shorter.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking with Christopher Baker. He's an artist and professor at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago. His installation, Hello World, is installed now at the U of I's Kranich Museum. It'll be there for the remainder of the year. Your questions and comments welcome at 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. And if you have something of your own to say about what inspires you, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Christopher, have you heard any feedback from people about Hello World?
That's a question that I've had several times, the most of the feedback I get from people who view it kind of has an arc that goes something like they walk into the room and are kind of amazed by the quantity, you know, the sort of visual complexity of it all, the visual, the sort of aural complexity of the sound. And then they have a seat and are just kind of amazed by the human qualities of people, you know, expressing themselves. And then kind of after a while, I think people kind of realize that, well, maybe this is a little bit depressing because all these people are talking and maybe nobody is listening to, you know, any one of these people in particular. So I tend to get a mixed reaction in terms of that. the audience's response, which is kind of what I'm going for. I'm kind of trying to capture that that excitement followed by the realization of the limitations of that technology. In terms of other kinds of reactions, people have often asked if I've ever run into anybody whose video has shown or they've seen their own videos on the wall, and actually I haven't. And I think that kind of speaks to the massive number of videos that are actually on the web. The chances of you seeing yourself in, you know, what seems like a large installation, which is actually just such a small quantity or small part of the total number of videos, you know, on YouTube that are of this type. So I haven't ever run into anybody who's found their video and haven't ever, you know, had that kind of feedback.
I was, you know, thinking about this as I was looking at the piece and thinking, well, yes, certainly I could go follow somebody's video diary on YouTube, and I can imagine myself going out, you know, right now, today, and just looking up somebody interesting and following them for a while. And I realized, you know, I haven't done that, except with some exceptions for people who I would say had actually crossed the threshold where their video diary became their job.
Right.
And it was really became a little bit more of a show business promotion, perhaps, than simply keeping a personal video diary.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever followed anybody's video diary that way as an individual on YouTube?
You know, I haven't actually. I think my experience is pretty much the same as yours. You know, where somehow a video has kind of percolated up, or an author has kind of percolated up through the system, whether they, you know, have committed huge amounts of time or production, you know, value to it, or have gotten, you know, found on something like Reddit or whatever. And that's kind of the way that I end up doing it, because there's just so many, you know, that are out there to listen to, which I think is kind of an interesting phenomenon, at least on YouTube, because I was fascinated by the fact that people have been journaling and writing in diaries for ages and ages, and usually there's kind of an imagined audience in that scenario. You kind of, you know, write Dear Diary, and the diary sort of stands in for your audience. But on YouTube, when you're broadcasting one of these video diaries, it's not often clear. Like the idea of audience is very, very much more ambiguous. There's the potential for having a huge following, people that, you know, if you did happen to percolate up through the you know, filters and all these sorts of ranking systems and things.
Christopher, have you ever kept any sort of diary yourself, and was it one that was completely private or something that was published in some way?
You know, the when I was a kid, I did a lot. You know, I think probably the full first 12 years, but I think I kept one right up until, I guess, high school. And I still go back and look at that occasionally and kind of read about my experiences as a kid, which is really interesting. But I think for whatever reason, as soon as I started using the internet and, you know, electronic communication and things like that, I've really been less likely to do that. And I don't know if that's my attention span has changed, or if there's a feeling that I'm already kind of recording so many things about my life, you know, in digital media formats, you know, in email or on Twitter or on Facebook, etc. But I don't currently write in a diary. In the traditional sense.
And I take it this does this sort of subject matter, all of these people who have their video diaries on YouTube, does it encourage you in a way to consider doing it again, or does it discourage you?
I think I'm still, you know, I still am a bit optimistic, maybe overly optimistic, about the idea that somehow I'll be able to mine my own data at some point, whether my email or my digital kind of trail. So it doesn't make me want to, you know, write in a private journal, if you will.
Well, Christopher, I made points of inspiration, the sort of the binding subject matter between you and our other guest. And our other guest is here, Claire Lieberman from Illinois State University is with us. No, the mic is fine, Claire. That's okay. Welcome to Focus, Claire.
Hello.
And, technology certainly plays a role, Christopher, in your point of inspiration and the potential and the limitations of what you can do online as far as self-expression and finding an audience. Claire, I was wondering, you're about to go on a ship with a bunch of artists, but also scientists, to the North Pole. Was technology, were there questions of technology that came up in the inspiration that you're seeking?
Well, one of the things that transpired as I thought about going on this trip is that there will be a complete absence of technology. And I wasn't thinking about that, but it'll be basically radio silence. It'll be the greatest kind of silence that I've ever encountered. And so while I'm a little worried because I won't have access to the internet as much as I'm used to having it, it's also very dreamlike and wonderful that there will be somewhere where it'll be, in my imagination, completely peaceful.
I notice in some of the written materials I see that one thing you're interested in is just something about the melting of ice. And, there is ice melting on the Arctic Ocean, and the reason it's believed to be melting is due to change in climate, which is pushed by human technology, and the idea that perhaps the Arctic Ocean, at least during the summer, will be ice-free by the end of the century. It sort of gives me the idea that maybe you really can't escape technology even at the top of the world.
Well, you make an excellent point. And whereas I don't feel that it will be possible to see ice melting and prove it myself, and I'm going as an artist, not a scientist, I hope to have build a greater understanding and learn from the other people who are also traveling.
But it also sounds like you're looking forward to the peace and quiet.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting also.
Christopher, I was wondering, in your case, you've run up against in your previous work and illustrated in this work, Hello World, I guess, the limitations of technology. Do you get the feeling that people would communicate better without technology, or is there just always going to be some complication as long as there are people there?
I'm a huge, huge fan of a hybrid approach. As someone who's teaching art and technology and teaching people to use these things, we always often run up to this idea that, or run up against this thought that, well, maybe you don't need schools anymore. Maybe you can take learn everything you need to learn over social media or over online video courses or something like that. And what I find is the most rich, kind of exciting conversations happen, in person, with real people, being able to look across the table, share a cup of coffee, have conversations. And so, I don't know, I think we're always going to need that physical, touch, that in-person conversation, to be able to look into someone's eyes and see the subtleties of their thoughts rather than, and I'm not one to say that the technology won't be able to do that or simulate that at some point, but I think we're limited by our bodies in a sense, and we need to be able to be in touch with our physicality, in our relationships.
Christopher, is this the only exhibit where you've used video, or is that or is that something that's a regular tool in your work?
It is the only video installation that I would say is kind of a pure video installation. I've done other visualization type projects using data from various sources, but those are usually more dynamic, graphical, interpretations of video. They may be video projections, but they're not, using the same kind of content.
And Claire, you've used video in some of your installations as well.
I haven't. It's not interactive. And I want to say that I'm very excited about some of the things Chris just said. I think that there's a tremendous potential for video as an art tool. We as artists are lucky to have so many different ways of communicating with people. And it's just exciting to see somebody working on something like that, that reaches out to lots of people and can go beyond the gallery, beyond the studio. I myself, in my video work, combine it with lots of other mediums, so it sort of has past and present, and I hope future embedded within it.
So it sounds like for both of your times, video is like one of the brushes, one of the colors on the palette that you're using, not the whole show, but a contributing factor.
Agree.
Christopher, this is this work, Hello World. I think you said it's about 5 years old. Mm-hmm. Have you been working on other works, continuing on these themes and questions since then?
Yeah, actually, I have. I'm working on a piece now. It's kind of an extension of a piece that I started a few years back, but kind of comes from a similar place with this, you know, concern with this idea of audience, of broadcasting yourself, et cetera. So if you ever go on to, or if you spend much time in the blogosphere, looking at people's, you know, written blogs, most, maybe not most, but a lot of them start with this phrase, "It's been a while since I last wrote." And then they go on to tell you how busy they've been and apologize for not, you know, for not keeping up to date. And that phrase is kind of turned into a huge point of inspiration for me, because I think it speaks to this idea that that people are concerned with their audience, this idea of the public audience. But I also have been thinking about it a lot in terms of the physical act of writing and the tools that we use for writing. So some of my new work is kind of a meditation on that idea of writing, you know, of our writing utensils or our writing tools, whether it be pen or text messaging or Twitter, actually shape the way that we think and the way that we talk, the kinds of questions that we ask, you know, et cetera. For instance, you wouldn't necessarily, or you might avoid asking really complex questions over email because you know that you're going to get a really long, unwieldy email response that you probably won't ever get to respond to. So in terms of how that looks in the gallery, I'm working on some new robot arms. And so they're these robot arms that are going to be attached to the wall, and they're going to be writing in my cursive handwriting as best they can, different phrases inspired by that that kind of blog post. They're going to be writing in chalk and making a lot of noise, so it should be a lot of fun.
Hello World, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Noise, is on display through January 5th at the Krannert Art Museum. Just for the final question, Christopher, tell us about the title. What's the hint that you're trying to give people coming to visit the installation?
Yeah, well, the title is sort of inspired by the Stanley Kubrick movie title, which is How I Learned to, the title being How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. And in that movie, there's a sense that as the threat of kind of mutually assured destruction of the atomic sort of Cold War era, you know, progressed, people just became more and more kind of ambivalent about the fact that there is this, you know, huge uncontrollable thing out there.
They were just planning on who got to go into the bomb shelter towards
right.
the end of the movie.
And so my title is that it's kind of one of those moments of throwing your hands up and saying, well, you know, I can't change this. I can't, you know, it's not living up to my expectations. It's not exactly what I want, but I'm going to do my best to understand it and enjoy it as much as one can. So,
well, Christopher Baker, thank you very much for talking with us today. And you can see his installation, Hello World, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Noise, at the Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois in Champaign through January 5th. Christopher, thank you very much for being on the program.
It was my pleasure. Thanks, Jim.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back to talk with Claire Lieberman on what it's like to get ready for a trip to the North Pole. This is Focus on WYLL. We're back on Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows here with Claire Lieberman, who is preparing for an ocean voyage, but not one to some sunny, warm, tropical island, the sort of place that people often go to on ocean voyages. Claire is a professor and artist at Illinois State University at Normal, and you are getting ready to join fellow artists and scientists on a trip to the North Pole, which means, of course, a trip to the Arctic Ocean. And from what I understand, there is an organization or a program called the Arctic Circle, which organizes these trips on a regular basis. You'll be leaving in, what, a couple of weeks?
That's correct.
Okay. And this is both scientists and artists. You're not the only artist among all those scientists.
No. There are many artists, and from all over the world, actually.
Okay. Why are they doing this?
The organization would like to create awareness about some of the issues that we confront, not just in the Arctic Circle, but all over the planet, and that is climate change. And they've come up with this idea, it seemed crazy at first perhaps, but that they would take this sailing ship, a tall ship, filled with artists and scientists to the Arctic and let them study and exchange ideas and research. And it's generated a lot of programs and exhibitions, and I think that they're hoping to create awareness about climate change.
Okay. You're saying a tall ship. Is this ship going to be dependent upon air currents and to get up there to the top of the world?
As far as I understand, yes.
They don't have a backup motor or something.
I hope they do.
Are you going to get to the actual spot of the North Pole?
No, we will be setting out from, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, Longyearbyen, and going 400 miles north. In the ocean. One of the fun things is that the boat will stop, or the ship will stop, upon request, if possible. And then people who are actually armed will get off the ship and go ahead first and make sure that it's safe before they let the artists roam around.
By armed?
With rifles.
Okay, now, are you going on land or are you going on ice?
On land, I think. Land covered with ice.
And you don't know what sort of territory you'll see out there. Are there going to be polar bears or anything else? You're hoping for polar bears.
I'm hoping for polar bears, but I'm glad that the people will be going in front of me before I actually get to meet them.
Have you ever been out to an inhospitable climb before for your work?
No, I have not, and I'm very excited, and it's a rare and wonderful opportunity, and I'm very grateful to the Arctic Circle.
Why do you want to do it?
A lot of my work has been concerned with water and ice. Deeper than that, I think it signifies something about survival, both personal and perhaps collective. And I felt that a trip like this to the Arctic Circles was such an opportunity to learn. And it also is very appealing. It's so exotic, and I'll be able to think, I hope, in ways that I've never thought before and see things that I've never seen before. So I'm just extremely excited.
What tools do you bring as an artist? You're a sculptor. You do installations. Is it the sort of thing where a sketchbook will suffice? Are you going to bring a sketchbook?
Yes, my goal is to make 100 drawings. I also plan to photograph and take videos, and I'm hoping to see polar bears and photograph them, but not get too close.
But you also want to see something about the quality of melting ice.
That's correct. I want to do drawings in actually gouaches, which is like watercolor but more opaque kind of paint. I'd like to make gouaches of ice flows and of the landscape, and I'm not sure quite where that will go, but it will generate new, larger works later.
And I was thinking, just looking, if you go to the Arctic Circle website, there are some photos that others have taken out there, and it's I can't imagine seeing those things up close. I'm looking at little pictures on a computer screen. Essentially, gigantic walls, cliffs of ice, which may or may not be melting. And the idea, you're a sculptor, how would you translate that into sculpture? There's something which is totally abstract, totally human beings are not directly involved.
Well, one of the materials that I use, and it's often in juxtaposition with other materials, is stone. That was how I was originally trained. And I'd like to borrow one of those robot arms that that we were just speaking about. To help me with my work. But I often work with white alabaster, and it has a milky, translucent quality. And in my imagination, that's like some of the snow formations or ice formations that I'll be seeing. And so a very large project that I'm planning for when I come back would be to use this beautiful, milky, translucent white alabaster.
And alabaster, is alabaster a stone?
It's a stone, yes.
Okay.
And it was actually, in the past, quite often used to fabricate lampshades because of its translucent quality. So wall sconces were alabaster. But anyway, I would like to use that along perhaps with video, and then a signature material that I've had a lot of fun with in my life, Jell-O.
Jell-O. And my producer, Lindsay Moon, had mentioned the Jell-O. How do you work with Jell-O?
Well, it's a very, actually, irascible material to work with. It's not easily containable, but that's what makes it fun and pleasurable to work with, and that's one of its signature
and
qualities.
And it's not permanent either.
It is not, and you've hit the nail on the head with that. It's a great contrast to stone, which is, in our collective imagination, I think is something we believe is permanent. And it does have a great sense of permanence.
Do you like Jell-O because it is not permanent?
That is actually what drove me to use Jell-O, is the idea that it contrasts so greatly with stone. And I was trying to think of ways in which I could take this age-old art, stone carving, very august, beautiful medium, and find a way to bring it into our time.
How long have you been working with Jell-O?
Since 1999.
And, you know, I think of Jell-O for some reason. I'm immediately thinking of cherry and raspberry, but I don't know what flavors you work with or what colors, I guess, are more important.
That's true, but it gives a wonderful sense of smell as well. So it's all
you are using flavored Jell-O.
Mm-hmm, I am, yeah. And I add additional industrial grade gelatin to it, so you can't, well, you shouldn't eat it. I can't be responsible for what would happen if you did, to stiffen it up just a tiny bit so that it won't collapse immediately. So there is a hand in it.
This does run into, you know, just one of the assumptions. No one ever necessarily said it, but one of the assumptions with artistic works, with paintings and sculptures and things like that, is the idea that they're going to last. And I'm realizing, talking to you and talking to Christopher Baker earlier in the program, there's no guarantee that someone's going to be looking at this 100 years from now, that they will be, that they will have something to look at simply because of the nature of what you're working with.
One of the reasons that I picked Jell-O, and I got this idea from other artists, I won't say it's completely original, is that it has the element of reproducibility about it.
You can always make more Jell-O.
You can always make more Jell-O out of a mold. So that has its own sort of lasting sense. But what attracted to me to the combination of Jell-O or gelatin, video, and stone, is that they all represent different kinds of time. And so, in effect, it's an exploration of all the different kinds of time that we experience. And you say it very, very well, so I can't actually say it better, that this is an argument that's going on today. You know, what is time in art, and what meaning does that hold for us?
The molds continue. So I assume you're talking about a gelatin molded in a certain way for mm-hmm. your work. I'm just trying to get, since it's hard to show it on the radio, if you could maybe describe a work in which gelatin plays a role.
Well, the first piece in which I used Jell-O was called Walking Through Jell-O. And as a matter of fact, I started by carving what appear to be water balloons in this translucent alabaster.
Water balloons?
Yes. Again, we're back to water, even though we're now moving towards Jell-O. And then I made rubber molds off of the stone pieces and then cast the rubber molds into Jell-O, or used the rubber molds to cast.
And what
Jell-O
quality did you see coming out of the gelatin versions of these water balloons?
Well, it was a great argument. The Jell-O was silly, funny, ridiculous. It was transparent, and it was wiggly. And when it was sited right next to its exact or its identical form in stone, it started an argument between the two materials, a positive argument. I mean, obviously, they're inanimate, so it couldn't be a real argument. But the stone itself has this great sense of deeper beauty. You can see the geologic a history within it in the striations that came from, you know, a long time ago when glaciers, well, I'm not a scientist, so I'll leave that to your imagination.
So do you see potential in the melting ice that you expect to see at the North Pole of translating of using these substances to show it to people.
Yes, and I've actually worked with ice as a medium. I guess I leapt from Jell-O to ice, and I've created forms that have melted away that are transparent.
And is the melting part of the process something that you want people to see?
Yes, it is. And what I'm hoping to find is inspiration for new projects that will communicate some of these really vital issues about climate change. And I'm not an expert from the scientific point of view, so I'm bringing an artistic point of view and hopefully a visceral connection for people who want to learn more about it.
And this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions for Claire Lieberman. An artist who's preparing for a trip to the North Pole. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WYLL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm wondering, you're going with a group of people. Are you looking forward to any interaction with the scientists who are there, not to mention the other artists?
It's just very exciting. People will be coming from many different parts of the world, so I'll not only have the opportunity to see a variety of creativity and scientific thought, but also just some unusual and new opportunities to hear about other cultures and the way that they're thinking about the same things.
Okay. What do you have to bring for a trip to the North Pole?
They actually asked us to bring as little as possible. Because it'll be pretty squished in there in the ship. But you do have to be very careful, I understand, and make sure that you have proper attire and gear. And it's a whole new system. I was going to have this great, fuzzy parka that I actually bought here in Champaign a while ago. But instead, there's a new system with three layers, one tight to your skin, one middle layer, and then an outer waterproof layer. And I had to go on a search for all that. And it's been a journey and very exciting to learn exactly what it takes to survive.
Wow, this is not something you can just pick up at Macy's, I guess.
No, I've been searching and working, and people have been lending me things. It's been exciting.
Is there something about the journey itself, as far as a way to get inspiration? It almost sounds a little bit like a pilgrimage.
That is true. I think the ship, the idea of going on a tall ship, which is something that is not of the modern age, is a very romantic idea, and it'll stir people's imagination, both people on the trip and people who are helping me get there, like Illinois State University and a private foundation that all donated to my being able to go. And it's just going to be, it's a chance to share something with my students and say, look, artists can do lots of things. We're not always alone in the studio. We go out, we meet other artists, we meet scientists, we talk about ideas, we argue about ideas. It's going to be very exciting, and I just feel so lucky that I'm getting to go.
And the fact that you're going on a trip, you're not a way a lot of people get inspiration these days is they go to a conference and then they spend a weekend at a hotel with a bunch of other people, and I guess that can be inspiring for the people, but going to the Best Western in Cincinnati may not be the same thing as going to the North Pole.
Well, that's a good way to put it. I think any opportunity to have your ideas challenged and try to see where they need work and where you can go from there, given the new inspiration and arguments that you've heard, I think that's an opportunity in and of itself. So.
Have you ever been able to find phenomena, natural or otherwise, just, here in central Illinois that inspires you?
Every day. I walk outside and the farm fields are so beautiful. I live like close to a farm right near me, and I'm acutely aware, like all of us who live here, I think, that we are the breadbasket of the United States, and we're very lucky. And I have a fun garden that I've been growing a few things this year, and I'm like, darn, I'm going to have to leave that. There won't be any gardens up in the Arctic. So
that's right. Who's going to care for your garden while you're away?
I have a neighbor that's been doing a great job all summer.
How has this recent hot weather and lack of rain been affecting it?
It's not so good, and so it's just another point, a signature idea about what we have to think about.
Now, going on this trip, and I don't know if you applied or did they invite you?
No, I did apply.
And are you under an obligation to produce specific work connected to this trip?
I think that it's very open, and their goal is to give us time, space, and in a sense, mental freedom to create. And what they're hoping for, I believe, is for artists to be able to share ideas and generate a great deal of enthusiasm for this topic and for each other. And I was very lucky that a lot of people who previously in other years have been on this trip were kind enough to write back to me. When I contacted them and share their ideas, and all of them were just completely enthusiastic. They said that it really helped their work, that it was a very exciting opportunity, that they had no idea what to expect, and that I should not worry too much about it. It'll be a great trip.
Did they talk about people they had met along the way, or were they talking about just where they were up there within the Arctic Circle?
Probably a combination, but clearly the Arctic Circle is so beyond like an individual such as myself. It's so beyond our ability to just say, hey, I'm going to just go up there and do what I want to do. It's so much of a combined effort. And so many people worked hard to send me there and the organization to even imagine this, that it's clear that it's just an extraordinary opportunity.
And who's paying for this trip?
Well, I have been doing a fundraising Drive Through USA projects, and I'm happy to announce that even though I had until September 15th, it concluded yesterday with a private family foundation named the Meyerson Foundation that helped me finish my fundraising drive. A lot of individuals, personal friends, people who didn't even know me but saw it advertised somewhere, and Illinois State University gave me a travel grant. So, and I do have some frequent flyer points that I'm using to get over there.
Well, congratulations then. How far have you ever traveled before?
Not that far. That's probably the farthest place. I've been to Korea once, and that was exciting. But this is far, not just in distance, but far because it's in the greatest realms of my imagination. So it's a really, truly distant place.
Now, that's something I just wanted the touch on, the realms of your imagination. This is an area, a place that you've thought of a lot, and this idea of all this ice pretty much untouched by people, except perhaps by whatever we've been doing to cause climate change. It just sounds like it really reaches out to you.
It does. I'm so enthusiastic about this opportunity. And one of the things that I want to do after having observed the polar bears, and I've only made one piece like this, but is to do a series of bears cast into glass that will resemble polar bears melting, so that there's a very direct image that I'm looking for. And I'm going to take a lot of photographs and then try to work up sketches from that and produce a new body of work. So it's an outstanding opportunity for me.
That idea of melting polar bears, considering what polar bears are up against right now due to the loss of really ice habitat out there in the Arctic Circle, that's a really interesting connection.
Thank you so much.
So do you think that when you're back and done, that the work you produce is going to be recognizable to the general public as art about the Arctic, or will it be more subtle, perhaps?
I think the series of bears will be directly relatable, and I've done a couple small ones before, and I'm hoping to go larger. My sadness is I won't be able to go as large as these giant polar bears. I think they're something like 9 or 10 feet tall, and they run very fast. But I think that there will be actually a direct and clear connection for people to see.
What are your students saying to you about this trip?
They're saying, wow, that's exciting. Can we come? And I'm like, yeah, you can go someday. It'll be great.
No particular suggestions from them as to what you should look for?
They're saying pretty much the same thing that many people are saying, which is, what will it look like? Don't get too close to the bears. That's a big one. take lots of pictures and come home safely. So they're a really good group. Thanks,
okay.
Guys.
And your peers, other people in either in your department or other artists that you work with. What have you heard from them?
Well, people in my in the School of Art have given me great suggestions for, say, camera equipment and ways to approach the very special light that's there. I couldn't be any luckier. I feel like I've gotten a lot of support from my family, from my parents, who I hope are listening. and from this foundation and from a lot of artist friends I have all over the country and many in New York specifically who've supported this because they know how challenging it can be to run a project like this.
I had forgotten about the light. When you're at the top of the world, your relation to the sun's going to be different.
That's correct, and it's something that I'm going to have to learn about. I don't know quite what I'm getting myself into.
Well, this is all the time we have now, but Claire Lieberman, thank you very much for coming to join us on Focus today. And maybe we can talk to you afterwards and see what your trip to the North Pole was like and what you brought back from it.
That'd be great, and thanks so much for inviting me.
If someone wants to keep track with you, are you maintaining some sort of email list, or is there a website of your work that people can go to?
Yeah, you can see my website at clairelieberman.com. During the trip, there won't be any internet connection, but after I get back, I'm going to post a lot of photographs and information about my experiences.
Okay, we'll make sure to have a link to that website on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus, as well as a link to the website of our earlier guest, Christopher Baker, of the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Claire, thank you very much for being on Focus today.
Thank you.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. Tomorrow on Focus, the Tuskegee Airmen, the all-black group of fighter pilots during World War II, received some of their first training at the old Chanute Air Force Base in Rantoul. This week, an exhibit on the Tuskegee Airmen, including a rare P-51C Mustang fighter plane, comes to the Chanute Air Museum in Rantoul. We'll talk with two of the men involved in caring for the plane on Thursday's show. Focus is live each weekday morning at 10, a replay at 8 p.m., and then archived to hear anytime at will.illinois.edu/focus. This is Focus on WYLL.